A reading from the first letter of Peter. Since therefore Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves also with the same intention, for whoever has suffered in the flesh has finished with sin, so as to live for the rest of your earthly life, no longer by human desires, but by the will of God. You have already spent enough time in doing what the Gentiles like to do, living in licentiousness, passions, drunkenness, revels, carousing, and lawless idolatry. They are surprised that you no longer join them in the same excesses of dissipation, and so they blaspheme. But they will have to give an accounting to him who stands ready to judge the living and the dead. For this is the reason the gospel was proclaimed, even to the dead, so that, though they have been judged in the flesh, as everyone is judged, they might live in the spirit as God does. The end of all things is near. Therefore, be serious and discipline yourselves for the sake of your prayers. Above all, maintain constant love for one another, for love covers a multitude of sins. Be hospitable to one another without complaining. Like good stewards of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. Whoever speaks must do so as one speaking the very words of God. Whoever serves must do so with the strength that God supplies, so that God may be glorified in all things through Jesus Christ. To him belong the glory and the power forever and ever. Amen. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. Jesus told them another parable, saying, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be like this. 10 bridesmaids took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. When the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, all of them became drowsy and slept. But at midnight, there was a shout, 'Look, here is the bridegroom. Come out to meet him.' Then all those bridesmaids got up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out.' But the wise replied, 'No, there will not be enough for you and for us. You had better go to the dealers and buy some for yourselves.' And while they went to buy it, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the other bridesmaids also came, saying, 'Lord, Lord, open to us.' But he replied, 'Truly I tell you, I do not know you. Keep awake, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour.'" The Gospel of Christ.
Over the time that we have been exploring the Gospel of Matthew, you've heard me say on a few occasions that one of the ways in which the author of the Gospel was shaping his gospel for his Jewish audience, he would break it up into 5 different sections, which would be mirroring the 5 books of the Torah. And so Genesis through Deuteronomy, sometimes known as the books of Moses, are kind of reflected in the fact that there are 5 discourses of Jesus found within the Gospel of Matthew. The first of these discourses was the Sermon on the Mount. And the last of these discourses is known as the Olivet Discourse, or the Apocalyptic Discourse, which is found in Matthew chapter 24 and 25. The gospel reading today, with the parable of the bridesmaids, is the beginning of chapter 25. And so in order for us to really appreciate what Jesus is getting at with this parable, especially since that's been our theme through Lent, looking at a different parable each week that Jesus taught, it would be helpful for us to understand what was happening in chapter 24 so that it sets us up for what he has to say in chapter 25. By the way, next Sunday will be the latter portion of this discourse from chapter 25. So we've got 2 sermons on the same discourse happening over these next 2 weeks. So to set the stage then for what's happening, Jesus has left the northern part of Israel. He's come down into Judea. He's coming to Jerusalem in particular, and Holy Week has actually already begun. The triumphal entry has happened, and then Jesus starts doing things that really ruffle feathers and causing some consternation with his cleansing of the temple and with the teaching that he directed, much of it towards the teachers of the law and the Pharisees. And actually, in chapter 23, he just has this lengthy series of woes that he would proclaim. Woe to you, Pharisees and teachers of the law, you hypocrites! And he goes on and describes why he says it that way. And I think the best way to read chapter 23 is to hear Jesus saying these things with a broken heart, for you to really appreciate the strong words he has to say to them. It's after having done this that we come to the beginning of chapter 24. All this time they spent in Jerusalem. And it says at the beginning that as Jesus came out of the temple and was going away, his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. Then he asked them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I tell you, not one stone will be left here upon another. All will be thrown down." And with that pronouncement, Jesus is saying that the day is coming when the temple would be destroyed. It would be completely leveled. It won't be there anymore. And that is a pretty remarkable thing for him to say, especially since the temple was the centerpiece of Jewish worship. It was understood to be the abode of God in the world, where it was that Yahweh would be in the midst of Yahweh's people. And it was the place in which at once a year on the Day of Atonement, the high priest would go into the most holy place to make atonement for the sins of the people right before God in this vivid way in which God was present. We might add, at the risk of the high priest's life. It was that intense. And of course, the people that Jesus is talking to will remember that there was a previous temple that 586 years before had gotten destroyed. Really, it should be 606 years because Jesus is 30. Anyway, besides that, when the Babylonians came in to defeat Jerusalem, they had destroyed the city and the temple. And so for about 70 years or so, the Israelites were without their temple, but then they got it rebuilt, and now it's been expanded upon, and it's gorgeous. This second temple is lovely. And to think that it would disappear again is a huge thing for Jesus to say. And of course, the idea is, what do we do if that day should come? And so the chapter goes on. They've now left Jerusalem, and it says, when he was sitting on the Mount of Olives... Now, the Mount of Olives is just outside of Jerusalem itself, and this is why this is sometimes called the Olivet Discourse. It's the discourse that happened on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will this be?" And so what are they asking about? They're asking, when will the temple be destroyed? That's their primary concern. In light of what Jesus had just said an hour or so ago when they were still in Jerusalem, now they're outside. When is this going to be? And they go on and say, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Now, because of that question, and because of the way in which Jesus answers this question, this discourse becomes known also as the apocalyptic discourse. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is we have a connotation for what the word apocalypse means now that it never meant then. The Greek word apokalypsis simply means revelation or a revealing. So the last book of the Bible, the book of Revelation, is actually called in Greek the Apocalypse. And it's just a revealing of something that is to come. Because of the characteristics of what we see in the book of Revelation in particular, and even some of the stuff that we read in chapter 24 and chapter 25 of the Gospel of Matthew, we have added a connotation to this that an apocalypse means crazy, bad stuff, disastrous things happening where, you know, the skies and stars are falling from the sky and all this kind of stuff. And now if you were to ask somebody about an apocalypse, well, they'll talk about the zombie apocalypse, or they'll talk about the apocalypse predicted by the Mayan calendar and all this stuff. And anytime you hear the word apocalypse, it just means crazy stuff is supposed to be happening. But apocalypse simply means revelation. Jesus asked, when is the temple going to be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming? And what will the sign of the end of the age be? They're just asking, when is this all supposed to come down? And so Jesus tells them. He gives them the apocalypsis, the revelation of what's going to happen. So knowing that that was the operating question that was presented to Jesus, we have to read chapter 4 and chapter 25 in light of that question. And the primary concern is the temple's going to be destroyed? That's crazy. When is that going to happen? And Jesus begins to answer that question. And in chapter 24, he begins to say things like, okay, beware that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead many astray. Why does he even bring that up? Well, partly because they said, when will this happen and when will be your coming? Now, what are his disciples thinking about his coming? Today, we tend to think of that being his second coming, his second advent, what we're still waiting for, but that wasn't on the minds of the disciples when they're asking this question. The coming that they are talking about, the Greek word here is the word parousia. And we have people talking about the parousia today as well, again, thinking of the second coming of Jesus. But what a parousia was the coming, the arrival, the appearing of a leader who came in victory to his people. The disciples have acknowledged that Jesus is the Messiah already. And so that's part of the reason they're asking this question. But they still have in their minds that Jesus' messiahship will be to literally sit on the throne of David and once again be the king over Israel and in victory lead them out from oppression by the Romans and so on. That's still what they have in mind. So when they're talking about your coming, they're talking about when does this happen? When do you have your parousia? We've already seen the parousia of Caesar as he came and took over things, but when is it going to be your turn? And so that's why he says, don't be deceived. Many people will come and say, I'm the Messiah. I'm the one who's going to lead the thing. He says, don't believe them. That's not what this is all about. That's not going to be the case. And he says, there'll be all sorts of stuff, wars and rumors of wars, but don't be alarmed. This must take place, but the end is not yet. The destruction of the temple isn't happening quite yet. And then he says, they will hand you over to be tortured and will put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of my name. And he's talking to this immediate audience. He's talking to his apostles and to his disciples. And we know that that was indeed the case for many of his apostles and disciples. A number of legends have been told about how the apostles died, and we don't know with absolute certainty that all of them were martyred for the faith, though that is the popular traditional thing to say. But we do know that Paul and Peter lost their lives in all likelihood at the hands of Caesar Nero. That martyrdom was part of the package. But Jesus is saying this to the people right in front of him. And he's saying that this taking place is part of the signs of answering the question you've asked me. When will the temple be destroyed? When will be the sign of your coming? And that kind of thing. And so then Jesus goes on and says, so when you see the desolating sacrilege standing in the holy place, as was spoken of by the prophet Daniel. So now he's invoking this Hebrew Bible prophet from about 600 years earlier, 500 years earlier. He says, when you see that prophecy being fulfilled, then those in Judea must flee to the mountains. Those on the housetop must not go down to the house to get their stuff. You just got to get out of there. Those in Judea must flee. When you see the book of Daniel being fulfilled, those in Judea must flee. This is very much to do with something happening right then and there. Why would those in Judea flee? Because that's where Jerusalem is, and he's saying that Jerusalem is going to be attacked. That's how come the temple is ultimately going to be destroyed. So he's talking about something that is going to be happening quite soon. He then goes on and he gives some of this apocalyptic language. Immediately after the suffering of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of heaven will be shaken. This is typical imagery talking about how significant that day will be when the temple is destroyed. These are not things that are literally going to take place. And then he says, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And we start to see things ramped up in another, much more visionary way. But he makes it clear that about that day and hour, no one knows, neither the angels of heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. And so what Jesus is saying is he's saying, I'm telling you the temple is going to be destroyed, but I don't know when that's going to be. Now, when we talk about Jesus speaking prophetically in this way, in a predictive manner, there's a couple of things that we have to keep in mind, just simply to let you know that the discussion and the debate is there. We know that the Gospel of Matthew was written in the 70s or even the 80s. The temple was destroyed in AD 70. So when Matthew is writing his gospel, Matthew knows that the temple has been destroyed. He's writing his gospel, and Jesus is predicting that the temple is going to be destroyed. So here's the debate. Did Jesus actually predict the destruction of the temple, or did Matthew, knowing that the temple had been destroyed, write into his gospel the idea that Jesus saw this coming? I'm just saying, the debate is there. Let's work with the assumption that Jesus could see the handwriting on the wall, as it were. He still acknowledges that, I know this is coming, I don't know when it's going to be. No one knows exactly when it's going to be, but it's going to happen. So be aware of that. Be mindful. Pay attention. This day is coming. And then he had said before, when you start to see this is going to happen, let those in Judea flee to the mountains and don't go down to get your stuff. Just get out of there when this happens. Because if Rome is going to march on Jerusalem, it's going to be in order to do violence. Jesus says, with regard to all of this, truly I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. This is a significant sentence for us to wrestle with. A generation in Hebrew thinking back then was 40 years-ish. Jesus said these things around 30 CE. 40 years later in 70 CE is when the temple was destroyed. It definitely happened within that generation. And so Jesus is saying, I don't know exactly when this is going to be, but it's coming up and it's going to happen pretty quickly. You know, y'all are going to witness this, or people of your age, of your generation will see this. And sure enough, that is what happened. If we were to take this Olivet discourse as being all about what is yet to come, something that we are still waiting for 2,000 years since, then what on earth did Jesus mean when he said, I tell you the truth, this generation will not pass away until all has been fulfilled? Because he uses the word generation, which means generation, which means 40-ish years. This is what helps us understand that what Jesus was talking about was something current and local and something nearby, and not directly about something that we're still waiting for. Now, the church has tried to understand it that way because it has become popular for us to take the apocalyptic discourse to think that it is all about something that is happening at some point in the future. You can imagine theologians in 1000 CE trying to think, boy, it's been 1,000 years, you know, when is this going to take place? And Jesus said it was going to be a generation, but it's been 1,000 years. Maybe Jesus meant millennium. But then you get past 1000 ACE, and it can't just mean millennium, because how would you hear it is now 2 millennia, right? One train of thought is something known as dispensationalism, and what that train of thought is theologically is that we had, like in the Hebrew Bible, you know, the dispensation or the chapter or the time when Israel was at the focus. And now that Jesus has shown up and now it's the church, now we are in the church age or the dispensation of the church. And once this dispensation is over, then Jesus will usher in the new kingdom and the millennial reign from Revelation 20, and this is another dispensation and so on. And so that interpretation is saying that we are in this particular dispensation, which isn't over yet, and that's what Jesus meant by generation. This dispensation will not pass away until. But you can see that it's trying really, really hard to get what Jesus said to fit what we have come to understand now, rather than taking what Jesus said and having it fit the context in which he is speaking. His primary concern in this discourse is about the destruction of the temple and what that will mean for everybody involved, especially of those of a Jewish descent, which, of course, all of his first apostles and disciples were. But having said that, there certainly is language that is included that seems to go beyond, that the destruction of the temple is not the end of the story. It is a significant and huge thing that's going to take place, but there is still more yet to the story. And that language is to be found here. But now, having set that tone, he then begins to tell a number of parables. And the point of these parables is about being prepared not only for the destruction of the temple, which was relatively imminent, but for whatever is yet to come. And this is where the parable of the bridesmaids shows up. The story that you heard Margaret read today was basically a parable dealing with real life, the way things worked. Back then, if you were going to have a wedding, the party would be 7 days long. How's that for a wedding reception, right? It was a huge event, but it all began with the bridegroom showing up in order for the wedding to start, whereas nowadays we always wait for the bride to show up, right? And so it was about that would kick everything off, and so that was an important moment when the bridegroom would arrive. And so here we have 10 bridesmaids. Don't read into the number. It's not necessary. There's 10 bridesmaids. Half of them are wise. Half of them are foolish. How are the half that are wise demonstrated? Well, they all have these oil lamps. They kind of look like the stereotypical genie lamp, but they're made out of clay. And you'd fill it with oil, and then in the spout is where you could light it, and the oil would feed the light, and you'd have a lamp. Because a lot of times, things don't really get underway until nighttime, and sure enough, that's the case here, in part because the bridegroom has been delayed. Everybody knew when they were expecting the bridegroom, but the bridegroom has been delayed. Jesus' audience for this parable would go, oh yeah, I've seen that before. Just like nowadays, we often wonder how long are we going to wait for the bride to show up at the wedding in the first place, right? It was just reversed, same thing. Why might the bridegroom be delayed? Well, it doesn't really matter for the sake of the parable, but back then it could be simply because he's still negotiating dowry stuff with the parents of the bride or whatever. But the point is, being prepared was key. The bridesmaids that had the extra oil were ready at whatever time the bridegroom showed up. Those that didn't bring extra oil found out that they were out and they couldn't participate. So when the bridegroom arrives at midnight after they've all gone to sleep because they're tired of waiting, the announcement comes, half of the bridesmaids are ready to go and the other half have to go out and get more oil. But by the time they come back, the door has been closed to the wedding. Once that door is closed, the upshot of that is actually kind of uncharacteristic to this situation. Those who were ready went with him into the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the other bridesmaids came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he replied, truly I tell you, I do not know you. Which is a little bit of an overwrought statement at a wedding celebration in which pretty much everybody in the village attended. To make that kind of statement certainly goes beyond the nature of the situation itself that the parable is based on. But Jesus is wanting to emphasize the importance of preparedness and readiness. Now, we have to be careful not to turn this parable into an allegory. What do the bridesmaids represent? What does the oil represent? What do the lamps represent? Like, that's not what the point is in this parable. The idea is, let's just all picture ourselves as bridesmaids, and let's be ones who are prepared. Ones who bring extra oil, who are ready for whatever contingency there is, whatever delay we're perceiving, let us be ready. That's the key point. And even at the very end, Jesus even mixes the metaphor a little bit because he says, therefore, I tell you, keep awake, for you do not know the day or the hour. Well, all the bridesmaids had gone asleep. The issue was the extra oil. So it's kind of funny that that's the statement that wraps this all up. But you get the idea, and the two or three or four parables that Jesus uses in this section all point us towards this whole notion of preparedness. Preparedness for his immediate audience with regard to the destruction of the temple, but preparedness also for whatever else is yet to emerge as a result of Jesus' true messiahship and what is yet to come. So that then begs the question, how then do we be prepared? How do we ready ourselves for the day that the bridegroom comes, for that return? However it plays out, what does preparedness look like? Because that's the operative term. You don't know when it's going to happen, so you just got to be ready. How do we be ready? Well, one of the popular ways of thinking about that, especially in North American Christianity, is being ready means making sure that you're saved. You don't want the door closed in your face. So you got to make sure that you're saved. You got to make sure you're a Christian. You got to make sure you believe in Jesus. That's how you ready yourself. But the problem with that interpretation is, in the parable, everybody's already a bridesmaid as far as who we're concerned about in the story. The identity of being a bridesmaid is already there. And the preparedness didn't have to do with their identity. It had to do with whether they were ready for the time when it came. And yeah, sure, in the story, they get locked out of the wedding, but it's problematic to think that readiness is just all about being identified as a Christian. Because if that's the case, we're all ready. There's nothing more to be said. You've been baptized, you identify as a Christian, you come to church, you're good, right? What more is there for this parable to say to you? Nothing. You've got your identity as a Christian. But that's obviously not what Jesus is driving at. What we have to realize now in this apocalyptic discourse is Jesus is now at the end of his teaching ministry, his ministry of presence, all the things that he is doing for people, because what happens in the very next chapter, chapter 26, is we go to the Last Supper, and Jesus goes to the cross very quickly after this. So the preparedness of this, he opens the parable by saying the kingdom of heaven is like 10 bridesmaids at this wedding thing, right? He opens it up again with what he's been talking about from day one. It's all about the kingdom of heaven. Everything he has said, everything he has done, every example he has been giving throughout his ministry has been about being part of the kingdom of heaven. And the whole idea about being part of the kingdom of heaven is to do the things that exhibit the qualities of the kingdom of heaven. And so the preparedness at this last discourse that he gives is to be, guys, take everything I've been telling you and be busy with that. That is how you are prepared. That is how you are ready. You are doing the work of the kingdom of heaven. And to put it a little bit an easier way to grasp, that passage in 1 Peter that Noel read gives us a lot of help. He begins by saying, since Christ suffered in the flesh, that is, he died, arm yourselves also with the same intention, for whoever has suffered in the flesh or whoever has died has finished with sin, so as to live for the rest of your earthly life no longer by human desires, but by the will of God. And then he goes on and says, the end of all things is near. Therefore, be serious and discipline yourselves for the sake of your prayers. And now comes the real particulars. Above all, maintain constant love for one another. Echoes of love your neighbor as yourself. Why? For love covers a multitude of sins. Jesus said earlier that you're supposed to forgive your brother or sister when they sin against you 77 times. Like, don't keep track, you just keep forgiving. How can forgiveness be freely given if love does not precede it? Be hospitable to one another without complaining. How can you be said to be hospitable, showing love to the stranger, if you're griping about it all the time? Peter is saying, or the author of the letter of 1 Peter, is saying that we need to make sure that our hospitality is not merely a show, but that it is something that comes out of a heart that is ready to be hospitable with others. Like good stewards of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. And gift here, I think, is a bit of an older way of trying to describe the talents and abilities and skills that we possess. And he's saying, use the stuff you're good at in service to one another and in service to others. This is what we're here to do. Whoever speaks must do so as one speaking the very words of God. Now, let me clarify this one. This is not saying that we should then take the point that we are inherently prophetic, and now when I speak, it is though God is speaking. No, that's not what he means. Instead, think of it this way. If when you speak, you are to be speaking the very words of God, that should automatically tell us what kinds of words we use, what sentiment we have when we speak. Because if we are speaking the words of God, I have a hard time thinking that God is going to be in a hurry to insult that guy over there, or to undermine that woman over there, or to gossip about this person, or to cut down this other person, or to just gripe endlessly. Speaking the very words of God is forcing us to consider how it is that we use our mouths. Whoever serves must do so with the strength that God supplies, so that God may be glorified in all things through Jesus Christ. The bottom line is that preparedness in this way is all about us taking all the lessons Jesus has given and putting them into practice in our lives. That's how it's done. That's how we prepare ourselves. And so for whatever the end of the age looks like, whatever ultimately is yet to come, whenever it happens, because nobody knows, and all of that, we are prepared by just simply getting it done. So let us, over this week, contemplate the fact that ever since Christmas, as we've been going through the Gospel of Matthew, we've been talking about the kingdom of heaven, what it looks like, and what those who are part of it look like. Let us understand that we are part of the kingdom of heaven. And so let us display that. Let us be ready. Let's fill our lamps and have extra oil by making it our practice to do these things. Amen.